Picking up tonight, of course, in Romans chapter 1. So if you want to flip over to Romans 1. So as you perhaps would recall, we've been focusing in on the 18th verse of chapter 1 for the past few weeks. And we'll move on into verses 19 and 20 tonight, but we want to follow Paul's train of thought here. So we're looking at Paul's assertion that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And we zeroed in on that particular point in our previous study. We saw that ungodliness is any failure to live entirely to the glory of God, and unrighteousness is any failure to live right according to God's definition of right declared in His Word. We also saw that far from man not knowing right from wrong, man suppresses what he knows to be right in order to do what he knows to be wrong. And for this is condemned. Now, remember, once again, Paul in this first section of the epistle, it's important, I'll remind you of this over and over again because it's just so important to keep this in mind. In this first section of the epistle, Paul is really God's chief prosecutor, building the case against humanity to show our absolute need for the gospel. You know, if I think I'm okay, then I'm not going to seek out any help, am I? If I think that I'm perfectly healthy, I'm never going to go to a doctor. If I think I'm perfectly safe, I'm never going to look for someone to deliver me or save me. If I don't have any concept that I'm lost, I'm certainly not going to be all that concerned about whether I'm found or not. Tommy, is that you? That was the longest ring on a phone I think I've heard. And it was a song, actually. So whoever that was, if you could turn that off, that would be helpful. So, anyway. Paul is doing, and of course he's led by the Spirit. We've got to see ourselves as hopeless, helpless, lost people before we're ever going to cry out for a Savior. Before we're ever going to appreciate the gospel, we've got to understand the depth of our desperate condition. And so, again, that's what he's doing. He's building this case. He is, in a sense, like I said, he's God's acting as God's chief prosecutor and building the case against humanity. So, having said that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, in verses 19 and 20, Paul gives an example of how men suppress the truth and thereby shows why all men are without excuse for their unbelief and disobedience to God's law. So listen to what he says. So having spoken of those who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, he says this, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divine nature, so that they are without excuse. So he shows us here. He says men suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and now he just points to an example of how people do that. They do that by refusing to respond properly to the evidence that God has instilled within us as his creatures and surrounded us with through the creation, instead of doing the thing that God would expect us to do as responsible, reasonable creatures, we do the exact opposite. Instead of looking at the creation and saying, oh, there must be a creator, and the creator must have a will, and therefore I must humbly seek for that creator. Instead of doing that, man looks around at creation and comes up with all kinds of other irrational types of theories about what it is or how it got here. And so in these two verses here, verses 19 and 20, Paul lays out truths that would later in history become the basis for what we call the moral and the teleological arguments for God's existence. Teleological, referring to the ideas of design and purpose. So in verse 19, first, notice where Paul starts. He says, because what may be known of God is manifest in them. Now, the word in could be translated among, but it obviously also could be translated in. That's why it says in. So I want to look at it from the standpoint of God manifesting in us this knowledge of his existence. And how is the existence of God manifested within man, within the very being of man, within the very nature and heart of man? How is that the case? Well, we see this manifestation of the knowledge of God in the universal sense of right and wrong. Everyone throughout all of time has essentially understood right from wrong, and everyone throughout all of time has, generally speaking, agreed on what is right and what is wrong. C.S. Lewis put it this way in Mere Christianity. He said, the law or rule about right and wrong used to be called the law of nature. The law was called the law of nature because people thought that everyone knew it by nature and did not need to be taught it. And he said, I believe they were right. I know that some people say the idea of a law of nature or decent behavior known to all men is unsound because different civilizations and different ages have had quite different moralities. But, says Lewis, this is not true. There have been differences between their moralities, but these have never amounted to anything like a total difference. If anyone will take the trouble to compare the moral teachings of, say, the ancient Egyptians, Babylonians, Hindus, Chinese, Greeks, and Romans, what will really strike him will be how very like they are to each other and to our own. These, then, are the two points I want to make, he says. First, that human beings all over the world have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not, in fact, behave that way. They know the law of nature, yet they break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking, Lewis says, about ourselves and the universe we live in. So it's a universal fact. Everybody knows intuitively, instinctively, the difference between right and wrong. You have to actually educate people against what they know to be true to bring them to a point of embracing the idea that there is no such thing as right or wrong, or there are no universal absolutes or anything like that. Now, Frank Drown and Marie, his wife, they went many, many years ago down to Ecuador, and they ministered in the jungles in Ecuador among the Shuar people. And when Frank tells the story of the ministry down there, in one of, you know, the stories that he tells, he uses this text right here to launch into the story, and he asks this question. Now, these were primitive people. They were people that had never come into contact with the gospel. In all of their history, there was no evidence that they had ever come into contact with the gospel. And so Frank, as he begins his lecture on this particular point, using these verses here in Romans 1, he asks this question. He says, what do you think the Shuar people knew? What do you think they knew in regard to, you know, things spiritual, things moral, and so forth? And then he says this. He says they knew a lot more than you would think they know. And he said that he himself learned from them that they absolutely knew that there were things that were right and there were things that were wrong. And they also knew that for doing wrong things, they would be judged. Amazing. No missionary had ever gone to them. No evidence that the gospel had ever made its way to them. But when they finally made their way to them, and in their book, The Mission to the Headhunters, that's the title of the book, they tell, you know, the story of this particular tribe. And up until their coming to them, no one had ever brought the Mosaic Law. No one had ever brought the gospel. But they knew in themselves. They knew in themselves what was right, what was wrong. And it was basically the same kind of stuff that we would know to be right and wrong. Now, atheistic or people who are anti-God, anti-Bible in the realm of sociology or whatever, they would say that we only think things are right and wrong because we've been conditioned to think things are right and wrong. So we think certain behaviors are wrong because we've had this imposed on us from the outside, they say. But what happens when they come up against a person or a group of people that have never had any outside influence imposing any moral standard on them, and they find that within the hearts of the people, there is this sense, this understanding of right and wrong? Of course, they deny that that is even possible, but there's plenty of evidence to prove that it's true. Now, here's the point, though. A universal law of right and wrong means what? It means there is a lawgiver. The reason why everybody knows this, the reason why it's instilled there in the heart of every culture that's ever lived is because God put it there. And that's what Paul is arguing here. Men suppress the truth in unrighteousness because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. And so we know, and even we ourselves can perhaps remember back, even as children, knowing that difference. And not simply because we were taught that. There were certain things that we might have been taught were right and wrong, but there were other things that we were never taught were right and wrong, but we just intuitively knew that they were wrong. Now, later in the second chapter, Paul's going to talk about this phenomena among the nations of the world outside of Israel who were living according to the moral law, even though they never had it. Paul said it's evidence that there's still a remnant of God's law written on the heart. So what that seems to infer is that when God created man, he created man with the law written in his heart. And what's happened is that sin has marred that. Sin has darkened that. So we don't see it as we would have seen it had we not sinned, but the traces of it are still there. So, manifested in them. But then he goes on, secondly, and he says, the knowledge of God's existence is also shown to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divine nature. His invisible attributes. What attributes would those be? Well, of course, it would be the attribute of omnipotence. His power. His power is evidenced in the created world, but also his omniscience, his knowledge, his complete, thorough, total, absolute knowledge of all things that could possibly be known. That would be manifested as well. But also, there would be the manifestation, going back to what we just talked about a moment ago, there would be, to some extent, a manifestation of his holiness because of that sense within us of right and wrong. So, creation, and this is what Paul's pointing to here, obviously, creation means simply and obviously, at least it should be obvious, that there is a creator. Now, Paul, even in his day, says that people rejected the revelation of God through creation. It's not a new thing. It's not something that's just happened as a result of the development of modern science. It is something that happened all the way back, not just in apostolic times, but it's something that's happened all the way back in history. People looking at creation and instead of concluding the obvious that there must be a creator to whom I'm accountable and so forth, men have rejected that. Last week, we had a conference and one of the speakers, a friend of mine named Trent Douglas, he was in the course of his message, he was telling this story. He had told me this story personally before, but again, hearing it again, it was just so fascinating. He does a lot of missions ministry in Africa. And Trent is one of those guys who, when he goes to Africa, he wants to go to the places where nobody's gone. So he's looking for people that nobody's ever been into contact with. So in the Sudan, he somehow gets connected with this tribe of people out in the bush that no missionaries have ever been to before. And so he's telling the story that as they come to them, and it's kind of humorous the way he tells it because he says, you know, they're all naked and, you know, very primitive in their whole lifestyle and everything. So, you know, it's kind of humorous as he's kind of showing how he was communicating. But he says to them eventually, and he says, they are so primitive and their language is so, such an isolated language. It took four translators to finally get out what they were trying to communicate back and forth. But what they were there to do, of course, was to share the gospel, to tell them about the true God. And so in talking to the chief of the tribe, this is what the chief told them. Again, no Bibles, no missionaries, nobody's ever come to them and brought them the gospel or anything even close to it. But here's what the chief said. The chief said this: we look at the sky, we look at the sun, at night we look at the moon and the stars, we see the hills, the rivers, the trees, the animals. And this is what he said. He said, we know there is a God, but we don't know who he is or how to worship him. Amazing. Now, this guy, this chief, he has responded properly to God's witness of creation. This is the right response. This is the logical response. This is the obvious response. If there's a creation, there must be a creator. You've got to get a PhD to conclude the opposite of that. You got to get your brain twisted and tweaked with philosophy and just nonsense. I'm not saying anybody with a PhD is full of nonsense. Of course, there are many, you know, highly intelligent people and godly people with PhDs. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, you know, so here's this guy, this chief, out in the bush, and he knows, it's obvious, it's got to be a creator. But you go to Oxford or you go to Harvard or you go to somewhere like that, and you know, oh, are you kidding? There's no such thing as a creator. And it's amazing that that's where things have come to. So Paul is telling us there's a witness in creation. There's always been a witness in creation. Nature and the complexity of living creatures and systems has been that voice all throughout history speaking to man of the fact that there's a creator, that there's an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wise creator. Now, in previous generations to the modern era and the development of the scientific method and so forth, obviously people, you know, understood a lot of things, but they didn't have the extent of knowledge that we have today about living systems, organisms, and things like that. They were, you know, to some degree restricted to, you know, just what the naked eye could see. But even being restricted to what the naked eye could see, God says that's plenty. It's plenty of evidence right there to work with. It's plenty of evidence to draw the proper conclusion that there's a creator. And of course, if you want to go back beyond the time when, you know, the microscope was developed and the telescope was developed and all of those kinds of things and all of the various discoveries that have transpired through modern science, if you go back, you still would have, you know, people understanding to some degree, you know, the eyeball maybe or the ear, but even then their understanding was limited. Darwin's understanding of the eye was limited compared to what we know today, but he still admitted that the eyeball was a stumbling block to his theory of his evolutionary theory. So here's my point. If those previous generations of people whose knowledge was limited about the complexity of the creation, if they were held accountable and guilty, how much more accountable and guilty is the present generation? Because the Bible teaches this principle that greater knowledge brings greater responsibility. Greater knowledge sets a person up for a greater judgment. And I believe, and I think we can support it biblically, that the present generation of atheists and agnostics are going to be held more accountable than those prior to the development of modern science. Because now it's all uncovered. It's out there. It's clear. As one of the guys who was teaching this past weekend at the Veritas conference was saying, in regard to Darwin, Darwin theorized that, Darwin didn't bother to try to come up with biogenesis, how life itself began. They just sort of assumed that that was a fairly simple thing because, you know, it was just the development of a simple cell. And in Darwin's day, that's what they thought about a cell, that it was simple. But of course, today we know it's not simple at all. And you think that his point was, you know, Darwin might even, you know, be, might be a little more gracious to somebody like him because he just assumed simplicity, but he didn't have any way of you know, actually testing that. But today we know that there's no such thing. But even with the tremendous understanding that we have today of the radical complexity of living systems, we still have people drawing the same absurd conclusions. So today we know that life, living systems, and we'll reduce it to cells, are extremely complex. And there are those today that talk about specified complexity and irreducible complexity. Specified complexity refers to the fact that something could only have been specifically designed for the very thing that it does. It could not have randomly developed that way. The design is too specified. It's too specific. You don't get specific, detailed, complicated pieces of machinery accidentally. Those things have to be thought out. They have to be planned out. They have to be drawn up. And then the blueprint has to be followed. And since that is what you have on the organic level, on the level, the molecular level, this specified complexity, to theorize that specified complexity is really not specified is just, it's irrational and nonsensical. And then there's irreducible complexity. In irreducible complexity, the reason why that is an important thing to understand in regard to evolution, because the cells basically tell you the exact opposite of what the evolutionary theory tells you. The evolutionary theory tells you that things developed in a process over long, long periods of time. Irreducible complexity says this thing had to come into existence complete. Because if you took one component of it away, it would no longer be what it is. It would no longer function. It would no longer do its job. So if you try to reduce the complexity, you lose the whole organism. So you can't have it developing throughout this long, long period of time. It just doesn't work that way. So this is what we know today. People know today that living systems are amazingly complicated. There's also something that we know today that, although to some extent a person in ancient times could have, you know, figured this out to a certain degree, but we have been able to see it on a much greater level, and that is what is known as the anthropic principle or the fine-tuning argument. And what essentially what that says is that the universe seems to have anticipated our arrival. We live in a universe that seems to have been prepared for us to be here. Anthony Flew, the man who became famous toward the end of his life for having converted from a life of atheism to being a theist. Sadly, to my knowledge, he never became a Christian. He died last year. But he wrote a book called There Is a God. And the subtitle was How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. He writes about this anthropic principle. Listen to what he says. He says, imagine entering a hotel room on your next vacation. The CD player on the bedside table is softly playing a track from your favorite recording. The frame print over the bed is identical to the image that hangs over the fireplace at home. The room is scented with your favorite fragrance. You shake your head in amazement and drop your bags on the floor. You're suddenly very alert. You step over to the minibar, open the door, and stare in wonder at the contents, your favorite beverages, your favorite cookies and candy, even the brand of bottled water you prefer. You turn from the minibar then and gaze around the room. You notice on the desk it's the latest volume by your favorite author. You glance into the bathroom where personal care and grooming products are lined up on the counter, each one as if it was chosen specifically for you. You switch on the television. It is turned to your favorite channel. Chances are, with each new discovery about your hospitable new environment, you would be less inclined to think it was all a mere coincidence, right? You might wonder how the hotel managers acquired such detailed information about you. You might marvel at their meticulous preparation. You might even double check what all this is going to cost. But you would certainly be inclined to believe that someone knew you were coming. So he says this, the vacation scenario is a clumsy, limited parallel to the so-called fine-tuning argument. The recent popularity has highlighted a new dimension of the laws of nature. The more I examine the universe and study the details of its architecture, writes physicist Freeman Dyson, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, knew we were coming. In other words, the laws of nature seem to have been crafted so as to move the universe toward the emergence and sustenance of life. This is the anthropic principle. So, you know, here's a guy who spends his entire life as an atheist, and not a closet atheist, but probably the most well-known atheist in the world. He was the one who gave the rest of the atheists their arguments against God. But it was these kinds of things, specified complexity, irreducible complexity, the anthropic principle, it was these kinds of things that caused him in the end to renounce his atheism. Now, like I said, you know, I don't know that he ever became a Christian. I've not heard that he did. He was surrounded by some believers. They shared extensively with him. So hopefully in the last moments he opened his heart to the Lord. But the point is, this is what he said throughout the book. He said, I have always made it a point in life to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Regardless of where it goes, I'm going where the evidence leads. And basically what he said, he had to, in the end, renounce his atheism because the evidence brought him to the conviction that there had to be a creator. So this is what Paul is talking about here. Now, today, we have scientific atheism is probably the clearest example of this kind of thing that Paul's writing about here in verse 20. That looking at the creation, seeing the complexity, seeing the design and everything else, scientific atheism rejects the idea of a creator. In a very recent article following the following a recent book that came out, Stephen Hawking. Interestingly, a man who a while back he showed that matter is not eternal, and therefore there had to be a beginning, and that the beginning probably was very similar to what we read in the Bible. He and a few other guys are the ones that kind of, you know, really brought forth the and gave legitimacy, for those who believe it, to the Big Bang Theory. The only legitimate thing about the Big Bang Theory is it simply says that there's a point in time when everything came into existence. It did not exist eternally. So Hawking at one point said that, but now he's retracted that. And listen to what he says now. Recent advances in cosmology suggest the laws of gravity and quantum theory allow universes to appear spontaneously from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. Our universe seems to be one of many, each with different laws. The multiverse idea is not a notion invented to account for the miracle of fine-tuning. It is a consequence predicted by many theories in modern cosmology. If it is true, that's a big, giant if right there. If it is true, it reduces the strong anthropic principle to the weak one, putting the fine-tunings of physical law on the same footing as the environmental factors. For it means that our cosmic habitat, now the entire observable universe, is just one of many. Each universe has many possible histories, many possible states. Only a very few would allow creatures like us to exist. Although we are puny and insignificant on the scale of the cosmos, this makes us, in a sense, the lords of creation. So here's a guy who's obviously a very brilliant person, but yet he says, now think about this. Existing laws have shown us that everything could have come into being without their existence. So what he is arguing here in a sophisticated way is that nothing created everything. And he says the laws of gravity and physics have told us that. Well, those laws didn't exist if there was nothing. So how could those non-existent laws teach us anything about what happened before they existed? So, you know, he's brilliant on one level, but obviously so against the idea of a creator that he's now going to this point of absurdity. And now this is the newest thing in cosmology, the idea that there are multiverses, that there are an unlimited number of universes. And why do you need an unlimited number of universes? Because if you have an unlimited number of universes, then you enhance the possibility of things happening in those. It's the same argument, really, as, you know, given enough time, anything can happen. Everything could have come together in all of its complexity if there was just enough time. We don't need a creator. We don't need a designer. We don't need somebody putting it together. Just give it enough time, and it would all come together itself. So now we're going to go beyond time, and we're going to theorize that there are multiverses. Has anybody ever seen anything outside of our universe? Of course not. You couldn't get out of our universe. And so it's all speculative. It's all theoretical. And it's all wishful hoping based on just the absolute refusal to acknowledge that there is a creator. I used this quote a while back from Dawkins. I'll use it again. It's a similar kind of a thing, going at it from a different angle. The world is divided into things that look as though somebody did not design them. Wings and wagon wheels, hearts and televisions, and things that just happen through the unintended workings of physics, mountains and rivers, sand dunes and solar systems. Charles Darwin discovered a way in which the unaided laws of physics, the laws according to which things, I love this, just happen, could, in the fullness of geologic time, come to mimic deliberate design. So that's the law. The law is the law of it just happened. Does that sound sophisticated and radically scientific to you? The law of it just happened. That's the law that Dawkins is referring to here. So he says this: the illusion of design is so successful that to this day, he's really mad at Americans about this, that to this day, most Americans, including significantly many influential and rich Americans, stubbornly refuse to believe it is an illusion. So it's all an illusion. The wings and the wagon wheels and the hearts and the televisions, they came about just the same way that the mountains, the rivers, the sand dunes, and the solar system came about, he says. And he says it all came about just through geologic time. Given enough time, billions of years, it just, you know, brought itself together. Now, I want to quote two more evolutionists. And these two guys are in the same position, except they're honest. Dawkins and Hawking are not honest. These two guys are honest. And I've quoted this, I've used this quote many times before. It's one of my favorite ones. It's by George Wald. George Wald was a Harvard biochemist. And this is what he said. I like his honesty. He said, "One only has to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of living organisms is impossible." So the idea that, you know, nothing produced everything, he said, it's obviously impossible. "Yet we are here," now this is where it gets really crazy, "as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation." It's impossible, but that's how we got here. "When it comes to the origin of life," he says, "there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. There is no third way. Spontaneous generation, listen to this, was disproved 100 years ago. But that leads us to only one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation." And now listen, here's where he's honest. "We cannot accept that on philosophical grounds. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life rose spontaneously by chance." The guy's honest. He's honest. He says this isn't a scientific argument. Science does not help us here. This is a philosophical issue. That's exactly what Christian apologists have been saying all the while along. This isn't a scientific argument. This is a philosophical argument. There are many absolutely brilliant people with the same education, with the same degrees from the same universities who believe that God is the creator. So it's not science. It's a philosophical issue. And he says, on philosophical grounds, we can't accept that. And I'll quote again, I quoted this in the last study, but just again, Huxley at least is honest here. In regard to evolution, he said, this was Thomas Huxley, we didn't embrace evolution because it seemed scientifically viable. We embraced it because it gave us freedom to live the way we wanted to live. So that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about Romans 1. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. By the things that are made. You see, creation is God's general revelation to mankind of his existence. That's what Psalm 19 tells us. The heavens declare the glory of God. You know, sometimes people wonder, well, you know, why are the heavens so vast? Why are there so many billions of stars? Well, one of the reasons is they're declaring the glory of God. You look at that and you say, that is astounding. That is, it's inconceivable. It's incomprehensible. Especially if you get to know a little bit about, you know, the distances of these stars, the size of these stars, it's mind-boggling stuff. But the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament or the sky shows his handiwork. And then it says this, remember, day unto day utters speech, night unto night speaks forth knowledge. Every day, God is speaking through what? He's speaking through the day. There's another day. Every morning when we wake up and the sun is coming up, God's speaking to us. How does this all happen? Why does it just do what it does? It doesn't. It does it because there's a creator and a sustainer. Day into day utter speech, night into night shows forth knowledge. And then it says this, there is no speech nor language in which their voice is not heard. See, this is God's universal testimony to man of his existence. Creation is the universal testimony. Creation is God's general revelation. Atheism and agnosticism are inexcusable. Atheism and agnosticism are inexcusable. Paul says that right here, so that they are without excuse. You see, God gave man the power of reason. No other creature has this ability to reason. This is, of course, because God made us in his image. But he gave us the power to reason, and he holds us accountable to reason correctly. God holds man accountable to reason correctly. So when a man looks at creation and he looks at intricate design and he looks at specified complexity and irreducible complexity and he says, that's not designed, that is the wrong conclusion. That will bring the judgment of God upon that person. So when a man does that, he's drawing the exact opposite conclusion of what his reasoning powers were intended for. But even though that's the case, God is offering forgiveness, even to people who have been in that position, even people who have been entrenched in that position, even people who have promoted that position. God is offering them grace. That's what this whole thing is about. Remember, Paul is telling us, again, in the context, he's not ashamed of the gospel. He's ready to come and preach the gospel. Because the gospel is the power of God to salvation, because the only alternative is the wrath of God. If people don't receive the gospel, they will experience the wrath. But everyone can receive the gospel. Anyone can receive the gospel. And there are some wonderful and amazing and powerful testimonies of Dawkins-type people who have come to their senses and repented and humbled themselves and finally acknowledged that there is a God and that Jesus is Lord. And that's what the bigger message is here in these verses. As Paul goes to build the case, he's building the case to show man his absolute helplessness in regard to this issue of having his sin taken care of and coming out from under the wrath. He's building the case to show him this is why there's a gospel. This is why Christ came. And so as we carry on in chapter 1, as we pick up in our next study, we're going to follow Paul's line of thought here as he shows that the world is under the wrath of God, as he shows that these certain people and lifestyles and so forth that he's going to mention here in the context, that these are all things that bring people under God's wrath. And again, why is he showing that? Because no one's going to look for a savior until they realize they're in trouble. No one's going to want to be found until they realize they're lost. No one's going to want their sin forgiven as long as they don't see themselves as a sinner. So, before the gospel can really come to us in its power, we first of all have to come under the conviction of sin. And that happens in a variety of different ways. But that's what Paul is dealing with here in the context. So we'll pick up in these same verses next week, and we'll actually, as I said to you, we'll actually speed it up for a bit, and we'll make it through the rest of the first chapter in our next study.